Hello, and thank you for joining me for the third episode in our special series of podcasts spotlighting the Arizona Institutes for Resilience and their work with individuals, businesses, and communities to manage risks associated with climate change and discover opportunities associated with solving the climate crisis. Are you ready to learn about the power of waste? For the next hour, let's talk poop, because poop doesn't lie. Get ready to learn about using wastewater epidemiology to test and track the COVID virus, organic material recycled from sewage known as biosolids, and man-made chemicals known as PFAs. We have it all for you today. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Impact Earth. We will not disappoint, trust me. Joining me to literally share with us everything we need to know about what poop can tell us is Dr. Ian Pepper, professor at the University of Arizona and director of Water and Energy Sustainable Technology Center. He is also the director of the University of Arizona National Science Foundation Water and Environmental Technology Center. One is West, the other is WET, and co-director of the new Water and Energy Sustainable Technology Center, known as WEST. Dr. Pepper is an environmental microbiologist whose research has focused on the fate and transport of pathogens in water, air, soils, and wastes. Most recently, he has developed the University of Arizona real-time sensor laboratory for the detection of emerging contaminants in water. And everybody, think about what that means now in terms of the pandemic we're living in and how it's transported and all the mysteries surrounding it. And from what I have learned, Dr. Pepper's work has always been important, but perhaps now more than ever right now as it relates to this global pandemic. Ian Pepper, I thank you so much for being here. You can tell from my voice, I'm excited to have you. I have already learned so much in preparing for the show, and I can't wait to educate myself and our listeners even more. So thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
I know. I don't know at which point to insert who wears a shirt that says poop doesn't lie. Now I know one person and you're it. And of course, I want a shirt.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do. I'm sure everybody that sees it and gets excited about it says, where do I get one of those? So clearly, the biggest challenge for me in preparing for the show is where to begin, because there are vast topics. And I think the first thing I'd like to share is a basic. You've been at the University of Arizona for over 44 years. That blew me away in and of itself. And it does beg the question, how did you get started in wastewater-based epidemiology as a field of study in the first place? That's what I want to know.
Well, I have a long history of conducting research with land application of biosolids, and also even 10 years ago, we were thinking of conducting what was then called sewage mining or sewage surveillance, and try to get funding from the DOD, and we couldn't get the funding. So when the pandemic arrived, we thought this was a wonderful opportunity to get into what is now being called wastewater-based epidemiology.
It sounds so scientific and so important. And it is. That's the funny thing about it. The end of the story is, look what you've learned from it. So share with us a little bit about the focus of the work at the West Center. And then can we just move into the important work centered around exactly what happened recently? I mean, it made a lot of the news here, but your work has really been hitting the headlines because of what you learned from waste, poop, and how its application for predicting COVID. So I just want you to talk and tell us your story.
Okay, well, as I'm from Britain, so let me say, as Charles Dickens would say, 2020 was the best of times and it was the worst of times. It was the worst of times, as you know, because of the pandemic and the isolation of people, wearing masks, everyone's life disrupted. It was the best of times because it ended up being perhaps the most exciting year of my career as we got involved in wastewater-based epidemiology. And almost 1 year ago to the day, I made the decision to put an advert on the West Center website. And the advert was that we would take samples of wastewater from any wastewater utility in the country and test it for SARS-CoV-2, provided the people would provide funding to pay for the assay. And it was very exciting, and I remember wondering, you know, would we get any takers? Well, we did. We got wastewater samples from Los Angeles, New York, Florida, Canada, all over the country. And so we very quickly then gained an enormous amount of experience in this technology of wastewater-based epidemiology, or WBE. And we would then assay the wastewater samples and report the data to the utilities in terms of gene copies per liter of coronavirus. And for each sample that we ran, I would write an interpretation of the data. So because we had hundreds of samples being analyzed, I got very good at looking at the concentrations of the virus in the wastewater and relating that to the number of COVID cases at that location at that particular time. So that went on from really the start of the pandemic, and we were really doing this pretty much ahead of most people in the country. Since then, the technology of WBE has really mushroomed, and it's now being conducted all over the states, in Europe, South Korea, Australia, you name it, it's being conducted. And I'm sure in a few years, we will have students graduating in the new discipline, wastewater-based epidemiology.
And they'll have shirts that say poop matters. Oh my gosh, I love it. I'm going to try and minimize my poop jokes, but I like them anyway. So zeroing in, my first question then becomes, how did people find that advertisement or that call for samples on your website? Just smart Google searches? Because that's amazing.
Yeah, recall that we are a mixture of microbiologists and engineers here at the West Center.
Right.
And we have a history of working with human pathogenic viruses. So, for example, we did work with the SARS virus back in 2009. And so the center is quite well known. And interestingly, a lot of it spread by word of mouth, I think, because the number of samples just seemed to keep mushrooming. So we had plenty of samples.
So that's unreal, because I'm going to reference the video I watched that I think one of your students did on YouTube, and I hope it goes from 84 views to 844,000 views, because you get the real inside look at what it means. You know, we just kind of gloss over these terms, the samples. Well, what it takes to get a sample, I'm not signing up for that job. I'm just telling you right now.
Yep.
It's not fun, and it's, yeah, you just like get down in that whole wastewater area and collect the samples. But one of the most exciting things to me when I'm doing the research for this is there's the research kind of in the abstract for the layperson, but then there's the application of what you learned that you applied in August of 2020 for students returning to the University of Arizona. Can you just give us a little bit about what you did, how you applied the research and expertise and your capabilities on campus?
Sure. Well, as I just mentioned, we gained a lot of experience testing the wastewater from utilities from March throughout the rest of 2020. And then in June of 2020, or let me back up, in March of 2020, the University of Arizona essentially shut down, like everything shut down last year.
Right.
And then in June of last year, the president of the university, President Robbins, came up with a plan for campus reentry in the fall semester. And that plan consisted of forming 7 teams to deal with campus reentry. They consisted of COVID testing, antibody testing, contact tracing, isolation methods, data management, thermometry, and also wastewater-based epidemiology. And I was asked to head up the WBE team.
I bet you were.
So, you know, my task was really simple, right? All I had to do was monitor the campus for a year. And how do you do that? I'd never done that. So I thought about it and luckily made some important decisions that proved to be very, very useful. This included the concept of monitoring the health of the university by monitoring student dorms, and critically made the decision that we would only monitor wastewater from dorms that were connected to a single sewer. So we had a discrete dormitory with a defined community, the residents within that dorm, and we could collect the wastewater resulting from that dorm. And that really proved to be the key to the success of our program. But interestingly, the 7 teams met once a week from June to August. And, you know, we'd never done this, so we were planning.
Right.
And we had, you know, discussions on how often to clinically test students, discussions on how often to test the dorm wastewater, what to do when the trolley comes down the road and almost runs you over as you're collecting the wastewater from a manhole. Discussions on how to respond to a positive wastewater result. So there was a lot of planning. And then finally, the magic moment arrived, the beginning of fall campus. So around the middle of August, the students began returning. The semester started on August 24th, and we started sampling. And by the way, the sampling of wastewater for dorms is conducted essentially by taking a sample from a manhole, which beneath which was a sewer. So we had a team of 2 young men that would take the manhole cover off, which weighs about 60 pounds, and then with a pole and a sample bottle, we would get the sample, take it back to the West Center, and assay it. So we were doing that then at the beginning of the semester, and one day after the semester started, we got wastewater from a particular dorm that was positive for SARS-CoV-2. Interestingly, although we had been planning all summer long, the response then was, oh my goodness, now what do we do? You know, I reported.
No kidding.
I reported the results at 6 o'clock that evening, because we typically collect the samples in the morning, take all day to run the assays, and get the results late in the afternoon. So we reported the results at 6. 11 o'clock that night, I'm woken up by a phone call from the president of the university, President Robbins, basically saying, you know, what do we do?
And oh, my gosh. I love this story.
Decisions were made then to retest the wastewater the following day and clinically test all the students for COVID-19. So really what the wastewater-based epidemiology does, let's say you're monitoring 18 dorms and only 2 of them are positive for the virus, then those are the 2 dorms that you concentrate your clinical testing on. And by testing every resident in that dorm, we were assured of catching anyone that was positive for the virus. And indeed, the next day we did that. We took the more wastewater samples, clinically tested all the students, and found 2 asymptomatic but infected students. And that was really important because if we had not tested the wastewater And if we had not found the two students who were infected but asymptomatic, they would have been free to roam around campus for several more days because wastewater based epidemiology is a leading indicator. So we're getting this, you're identifying the people before they had symptoms and preventing preventing exponential spread.
And it was, to me, I just want to inject here that it was in one of the things that I researched, and it all becomes one in my brain, that it can predict 10 days earlier than the symptoms can manifest. Is that right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a really early indicator.
It's an early indicator, and there's a progression of all of the events associated with COVID. So the wastewater-based epidemiology is the leading indicator, and typically 7 to 10 days after that, you will see people with symptoms, and the case count then begins. Subsequent to that, of course, you get hospitalizations occurring, and finally, of course, mortality or deaths. So there's a whole spectrum of events there. So that whole story of identifying the two asymptomatic but infected students really caught the media's attention. I think we had about 200 media hits in August and September, broadcasts with CNN, NPR, CBS, NBC, ABC, publications in The Atlantic and Politico. The headlines were many, and some were really funny. Perhaps my favorite newspaper headline was, "How the University of Arizona used number two to solve its number one problem, the coronavirus."
I love it.
Which is kind of,
I love it.
It's kind of priceless.
It is priceless. And the name of the YouTube video was Solution Number Two. And I was looking at it. I mean, Gina, come on. And I had to go through the whole thing and think, oh, yeah. I was thinking, what's solution number one? Oh, I get it. I was like a little late to the party on that one. But your student articulated it quite well. But Ian, what about in terms of the effectiveness as it played out? Like, now we're a year into COVID, mm-hmm. we're having our anniversaries all over the place. Mm-hmm. What was the overall accuracy of WBE as an early warning diagnostic tool? What did you find, and what do you continue to find?
Okay, well, and we've just been writing up the data from the study for a publication that's just accepted, be coming out shortly. We repeated that scenario of catching infections early 80 times in the fall semester. So potentially we reduced exponential spread 80 times. And that is why I believe one of the main reasons why the University of Arizona was able to remain open throughout the fall semester, whereas I'm sure you recall, many universities were not able to do that.
Right.
They became overwhelmed.
Right.
And they had to close up shop. If you want to really quantify how accurate the WBE was, I have some data here from the paper. The positive predictive value of WBE was 82%. Oh. That means that 82% of the time, if we had a positive wastewater, then we would find clinical infections. The reason why sometimes you may not, why isn't it 100%? Well, you may have someone visiting the dorm that uses the restroom,
right,
and then leaves. And so you would never catch them as a clinical test. So also sometimes, you know, it wasn't possible to capture, or rather to test, every single resident if people were out the following day. The negative predictive value was 88.9%. And that means that 88.9% of the time, if the wastewater was negative, then you would see, you would get no clinical infections. So it really was a true negative result.
I mean, and that had like the shock heard around the world in the scientific community. I mean, to me, it's like knowing what I do, it's unbelievable. And then I don't understand about how it's an indicator for asymptomatic cases of COVID-19. If you're not showing symptoms, can wastewater detect the virus?
No, it's not that. What wastewater is doing is telling you where to clinically test. So,
got it.
As I said, if let's say you had 18 dorms, rather than blanket testing a number of a selected population within those 18 dorms for the virus, you concentrate on the ones which are positive for the virus and test everyone in that dorm. And you know, you started off talking about a catchphrase that I started using early last year, poop never lies, and it was a catchphrase. However, it really is true. Poop never lies. If the virus is in the wastewater, it has emanated from someone that is infected.
Got it.
So.
Got it. So what about now? What are you doing with it now? Are you still testing? And I, you know, a question that I have later on that I wanted to ask you is this application and this being able to use WBE for this early diagnostic tool. I'm personally not of the opinion that COVID is the last pandemic we're going to see, and I'm not a pessimist.
Yeah.
But if it happened once, and I mean, talking to my friend Jim Beiser, I have to admit I have some inside scoop, but it's not the end of this, and not to spread fear, but will you be able to, will this be applied research that you can be using for other things? Like, what are you up to now in this area?
Well, a lot of things.
I bet.
Let me tell you about Yuma, which is a city on the southern edge of the state. And Yuma, it was very concerned about coronavirus for three reasons. One, they had the farm migrant workers coming in from over the border
right.
in the fall. They had the snowbirds who were elderly. And they have a military base there that was bringing in people from all over the world. So they were very concerned about the potential for COVID-19 infections. And I gave a seminar, which was listened to by the mayor of Yuma and also some of the state legislators. So we ended up getting $250,000 from the Yuma Board of Supervisors, another $500,000 from the state. And we've divided the city up into 13 regions and also identified key high-risk buildings within each of the region. So we're sampling wastewater from manholes. If we get a positive hit, we then go and test the high-risk buildings. And so far, we've kind of repeated the same success with the dormitories in a retirement home. And I think the other one, I think, was a nursing home. We're working with Paul Briley, who runs a center down there in Yuma, and we helped him set up a COVID lab. So really, it's the idea of identifying hotspots, again, before the cases break out, then notifying county health officials in advance of the enhanced case count, and that this allows them to maximize their resources.
So it's the applications go on and on and on. I mean, that's another one. And I'm sure it's
yes.
in demand to help be a predictive of prevention and treatment and all of those things, you know, containment. So I was like, oh my gosh, there's so many things that can be done with this. So are we complete with talking about this part of it? Because there's two other areas I want to talk about besides waste, wastewater-based epidemiology, and I want to make sure we have time for it and not rush. The only other question I did want to ask, which sounds like, do I really want to ask this? If I asked 100 people on the street, what is the coronavirus? What is it? Do you think that the results would be interesting at best? Like, even if you ask me, I would say it's a virus. Is that an important, relevant question for us to be able to understand? What is the coronavirus?
I think you can easily go down the rabbit hole if you start talking about viruses. So if you say virus, people kind of sort of know what it is.
Right.
If you delve deeper, it can get very complicated very quickly. And I did want you to know a couple of other applications of wastewater-based epidemiology. One that has been ongoing already. People look for the concentrations of illicit drugs in sewage.
Oh my gosh.
And from that, they can deduce the number of users in the community. And the other one is shotgun viral metagenomics, in which you can look for sequences associated with virus that might indicate a future pandemic before it actually got started.
I can't even, I think that's like a whole other show.
Yeah.
I'm serious, because when you talk about the rabbit hole, when it's shows like this, I am in the rabbit hole.
Yeah.
And I'm clicking on this and reading about this and asking a definition about this. It's part of the one of the main reasons of why I love what I do and why our listeners love it, because they're like me, the person on the street that wants to know more and have someone tell us what it means in English. And it's shocking to me in a very positive way. Of course, you can find out about drug use, and that can be very helpful to give support to different neighborhoods and protection and all of those things. So that's a wonderful application, if you ask me, as a person who believes in prevention and treatment and all of those things, instead of blame and getting them and all that stuff. But anyway, so that's profound. I am sure you will be back on my show again in 1 year, talking about the next thing that's happening. But so let's go on to biosolids, because that's another area. It's one of the only things, like, I am one of those persons that's like, ew, come on. And I don't think I'm that squeamish. I don't, but maybe I am. So what are biosolids, and how have they impacted your career?
Well, they've been fundamental to my career. And let me first say that, you know, biosolids, you may think badly of them, but it's been my bread and butter.
One man's, what is that thing? Another man's treasure?
Yeah. So interestingly, and I've done this with students, if you ask people, you know, what are biosolids, they don't know. So then the next question I ask someone is, what happens when you go to the bathroom and then you flush the toilet? What happens?
Right.
And you usually there's a blank stare, and I kind of prompt them, and finally they get it and go, oh, the material goes into a sewer, which ends up in a wastewater treatment plant. And the wastewater treatment plant treats the sewage. And by the way, wastewater treatment is perhaps the greatest single achievement with respect to sanitation than anything else you can think of. So prior to wastewater treatment in the big cities like Philadelphia, New York, Chicago, they used to put raw sewage in the streets, and every year millions of people would die. So wastewater treatment is a fantastic innovation.
Incredible. And can I just inject here, think about the countries where they don't have it. Because I did an interview with a guy from Habitat for Humanity about Bangladesh. And I was like, I just said to him, you know what, John? I don't think I ever want to go there now.
Yeah.
It's really, when you don't have it, We are so blessed in this country for those silent protectors. They're invisible to us, and they keep us healthy. So yes, you're right. And it's where does poop go? Well, it goes away. For most people, it goes away. That's all.
Yeah.
It goes away. So this is the biosolid is what's left. Is it what's left after you take all the water out of it? I mean, is that a layman's example? Educate me, Ian.
So during wastewater treatment, the material is treated. And by the way, that's a key concept. The term biosolids means that the material has received treatment.
Got it.
And it's the end of the treatment that results in the solid portion, which is the biosolids, and a liquid portion, which used to be called effluent, is now called reclaimed water, and that's used for irrigation. So here in Tucson, we have the longest reclaimed water irrigation system in the country.
Right.
It's used for golf courses. And with respect to the biosolids, I'm very proud to say that we recycle 100% of the material through land application. And I'd like to thank each and everyone for their contribution to that recycling.
Oh my gosh, everybody's a player in this scenario. But Ian, what do you mean? What do you do with them when you talk about land application? What is that?
Well, the end product, the solid end product of wastewater treatment or biosolids is essentially a wonderful organic fertilizer, a slow-release organic fertilizer, and plants love biosolids. You put biosolids into soil and grow plants, and they will almost jump out of the ground.
Oh, my gosh.
So it's fantastic for growing plants. And don't forget, you're adding carbon into the soil, so you're
right.
Sequestering carbon. And we've done studies showing that the percent organic carbon in the soil will increase under the scenario of repeated land application. So nationally, about 60% of the biosolids produced at all the wastewater treatment plants, and there's about 16,000 of them nationwide, is land applied. And that's very different than, say, Germany, which was incinerating the biosolids, which is terrible for two reasons. One, what a waste of organic carbon.
Right.
And two, unless you're very careful, you will get air pollution.
Which is not a good idea. And I have to say, injecting my humor a little bit, this is not something you should try at home. You should not be using your own waste for...
No.
It has to be treated.
Correct.
It has to be treated, correct?
Correct, okay. Yes.
Good on that one. It's not like composting. So why are people... What's the controversy about it? Why are some people against it? I'm in the house now. You sold me. I understand. And when you talk about carbon and all of that, it's like a Mrs. Green dream. But why are people against the land application piece?
Well, environmental activists loathe land application.
Oh.
And the big driving force behind the loathing is actually odor. When you land apply, there is an odor associated with it until that material is tilled into the soil. And historically, odors have been associated with disease.
Got it.
And so now, if you have a resident close to where land application is going on, and they smell this rather not too pleasant smell... And then on top of that, they think, well, what if there are viruses being aerosolized and I'm breathing them in?
Got it.
Then that's a very powerful motive to dislike land application. Some people also have psychosomatic problems with land application. It's kind of similar to, some people will throw up if you ask them to eat liver. Well, there's nothing about eating liver that should make you throw up. In England, it's a delicacy. But for the people with that psychosomatic problem, that throwing up is very, very real. So there's been a lot of education nationwide to try to educate people to the benefits of land application of biosolids and why it's a really good thing. And so I got involved studying land application of biosolids back in the mid-80s when Pima County Wastewater agreed to fund 1 year of land application research. And so I started doing it, and we were actually looking at crop yields of cotton under the influence of land application, replicated field trial with all the appropriate controls. And we got some good data. And the following year, Pima County Wastewater funded it again.
Wow.
And they did it again the third year, and the fourth year, and the fifth year. And by then, I realized that we had something. To cut a long story short, they funded it 20 years annually.
What?
So I had a 20-year field study, which is insane. Because
it is insane.
I can assure you, no assistant professor at the University of Arizona is going to say, I think I'll start a 20-year study.
Never. Said no professor ever. But that speaks volumes about their vision. I mean, it's a very good thing to say. And so what happened? I mean, did it improve yields and quality, or what do you keep learning, and what did you learn from that 20-year study?
Well, agronomically, I told you plants love biosolids,
right?
And you get fantastic yields with land application of biosolids. Interestingly, I said we had controls and various treatments. One of my bright ideas, which wasn't a bright idea, was the thought that what if we put, if you have a given rate of biosolids that you need to provide the nutrients for plant growth, what if we put three times as much on? Could we then apply the material 1 year and grow crops for 2 or 3 years without, you know, adding more material? So that was the thought, and it actually ended up being okay, because after 20 years, we now had like a worst-case scenario of a 3x rate for 20 years.
Wow.
And looking at potential hazards. However, the first year we put the 3x rate on, the plants grew. And boy, did the plants grow. They loved the biosolids and the nitrogen, and the cotton was, over 5 foot tall. It was all vegetative growth and not much cotton. So agronomically, it was a bust, but it was very good. The other story that I remember vividly was we had plots that were over 100 yards long, 10 yards wide, and we would take composite soil samples by marching down the plot length 100 yards. And I was doing that in... oh, I think it was about 10 years into the 20. And this is row irrigation of cotton, and Morning Glory had grown over the cotton so that it was like a mass of vegetation. But I was determined to get my sample, so I continued. And apparently I trod on a hive of Africanized bees and was then stung for like half an hour. I remember lying on my stomach thinking, well, I'll sacrifice my back better than my face.
Oh, dear Lord.
And I was lucky. I had students with me, but they couldn't do anything because of the bees.
That's like,
except they did call 911. And so
that's good. It's like one of my worst nightmares. Like, seriously, oh my goodness, that sounds like a horror story. And thank God you weren't allergic, obviously.
I remember thinking that.
Because you're still here talking to me. Oh my gosh. So just for a minute, this is like not really off the grid, radar, whatever, but the whole psychosomatic conversation. I remember maybe 5, maybe 7 years ago, I had someone on from Pima County Wastewater, and they were going around and they were experimenting with a beer truck. Their beer made from treated water. And I gag from thinking about that. And they said, Gina, it is purer than any water you're drinking out of your faucet. Trust me. But there is that piece, like I'm drinking,
I know,
you know, urine or poop or whatever. It's like, oh, this is hard for me.
We were a major part of that study. We applied with Pima County for the Arizona Water Innovation Challenge.
Right, that's right. That's what it was called. Good memory.
And we won it. And so, you know, you're supposed to say, what was the innovation? Well, the innovation was to get a semi and build an advanced water treatment train on the back
wheels.
Of the semi, on wheels.
Yeah.
And then we drove it to various towns and cities. We'd go to the wastewater treatment plant. We'd treat the water. We would show people the advanced treatment train. We had a little electronic laptop that people could take a quiz. And the idea was to improve people's vision and acceptance
right.
of reclaimed water.
Right.
And, of course, the deal was that if you treated water and then offered the treated water to someone, they'd say, no thanks. However, if you then use that water to produce beer with the microbreweries and you offer someone free beer, that's a whole different ballgame.
Yes.
People love it.
I know. It gets exciting, and it just breaks down those barriers. And as a champion for the planet and an environmental activist, finding ways to change, to use that white wastewater for drinking water, we better get our heads around it because that's what's coming. So I think that's really an important thing for me to get over and lots of other people. It's totally psychosomatic. It's not real.
I can tell you that as the amount of water you have decreases, your psychosomatic problems will go away. And that was shown in Australia where they had a really severe drought. And people accept reclaimed water very easily.
Like, just give me a cup. I get it. So if we're complete with that section, I think we're going to get to cover everything Gina ever wanted to know from Ian Pepper for now. let's move on to perfluorinated compounds. And I had to practice that, PFAs. And I want to know why you wanted to cover this and why it's important that we, as residents of the planet, learn more about them.
Okay, let me start by saying, during the 20-year study, we became perhaps one of the premier research groups in the world on land application of biosolids. 20 years is a long time. We had time to study many things. And one of the things we did was take on the chemical du jour or the pathogen du jour. And so we studied an awful lot, bioaerosols, prions, the Ebola virus, using surrogates, by the way, because we do like our graduate students, antibiotic-resistant bacteria. We studied everything. And at the moment, the most prominent potential hazard associated with land application is the presence of perfluorinated compounds, which are abbreviated as PFAS.
PFAS.
Yeah, that's the generic term for all the perfluorinated compound analytes. The two most well-known compounds are PFOS and PFOA. And these are long-chain organic compounds that are fully fluorinated. And they're used to make products resistant to heat, oil stains, grease, and water. And recently, then, the issue has been that there are health effects associated with PFAS. It's thought that everyone in the country has PFAS in their blood. And so now reducing exposure to PFAS has become a big deal. And one possible route of exposure was PFAS and PFOA in biosolids, which you would expect.
Got it.
You would expect it to be there because people use, these compounds, and it ends up in the sewage.
Right.
So then what is the potential for PFAS from biosolids to leach into groundwater? That was the issue, and the standards for concentrations of PFAS have been going down and down. EPA lowered their health advisory level to 70 parts per trillion for a combined PFAS and PFOA. And some of the states are now down to like 20 parts per trillion, which is insanely low. So the Pima County Board of Supervisors heard about PFAS in biosolids and in their infinite wisdom put a moratorium on land application in Pima County in January 1920. That meant no more land application.
You mean January 2020?
Correct. Just over a year ago. What that did for Pima County wastewater, they now had to landfill the biosolids, which raised the costs of getting rid of the material from about $1.3 million annually to about $3.7 million annually. Plus, it prevented the local farmers using biosolids, and the farmers love biosolids. So this was an issue, and now go back. You know, I said we had the 20-year study.
Right.
I'd been working with Pima County Wastewater since about 1985, and we had long-term plots with known amounts of biosolids applied, and so we could now take samples of soil from those plots, some of which had been receiving biosolids for 35 years. And we had incremental loading rates so that we could look at the effect of different duration of years of land application on the incidence of PFAS. We also had some plots from irrigated agriculture without land application of biosolids. And what was interesting was we found that the incidence of PFAS in the soil from the plots that had received biosolids was almost identical to the concentrations were in the irrigated agriculture that did not receive biosolids. And then the missing link, of course, was that we analyzed the irrigation water and found that there was PFAS in the irrigation water.
Oh.
So, you know, that's, we think, where the majority of the PFAS was coming from. So that was one important outcome of the study. This is rather a unique situation, having like 35 years documentation of the amount of biosolids applied to soils.
It begs the question to me. I mean, I know a lot about what's going on or how things work with Pima County and the Board of Supervisors and the wheels turning very slowly on many things. How did it happen? Who was instigating it? What was that? Is that even fair to ask? I don't want to rat anybody out, but like, you don't want to answer?
you can ask because I know the answer.
What is it? How did it happen?
Well, there was a local farmer who actually riled up the Board of Supervisors. And again, it's easy to get people heated up.
You right, know, especially if you're using fear.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
So that's what started it. We completed the study. We started the study in about March, and we finished it in October and wrote it up and presented the data to Chuck Huckleberry, and the moratorium on land application was raised or removed in November 2020. So we're back in business again.
We're back in business. Well, that makes me want to do the happy dance right here on my podcast. But that's very good to know. And some of those decisions, like you said, and it just absolutely puts a spotlight on. If you think one person can't make a difference, think again. So if you want to be an agent for change, for positive, the Board of Supervisors, they will listen. If you have a cohort or a cadre of people, they will listen and just make sure it's something that is good for the community. Okay, so another big question, and I kind of skirted around it, but I want to know what you really think. Do you think that it's possible that a year or two from now, we are going to be sitting here on this call talking about another virus or another pandemic and how your research is addressing some of what could be happening with them? And I talk about Jim Beiser because he's a friend, and we get on these two-hour phone calls. And, you know, he talked to me one Saturday afternoon, and he said, you just can't think that this is a one-off.
No.
You know what I mean? You just can't.
Yeah.
And he's so proud of the work that's being done under the auspices of the Arizona Institutes for Resilience, but also
correct,
all of the other pieces of it that are being brought together. So are you, I mean, there's no crystal ball, but I get excited because of the work you're doing that we can maybe, you know, nip it in the bud faster, find
yeah,
antidotes for it sooner, all of those things, because we'll be more prepared.
No, you're exactly right. And this may not be intuitive, but wastewater-based epidemiology, for example, is obviously very useful when you're in the midst of a pandemic, because with repeated samples from wastewater
right,
over time, you can tell whether the pandemic is increasing or decreasing or plateauing. And incidentally, every major holiday last year, 1 week after the holiday, you know, Memorial Day, Labor Day, Independence Day, Halloween, Thanksgiving, Christmas, 1 week later, we'd see the concentration of the virus go up in the wastewater.
Oh.
And 2 weeks later, we'd see number of cases increasing. And
I hope people are listening to you. Like James and I got the vaccine, and we know it's not a license to party. I mean, it isn't. It's still being contemplative and intentional and careful so that we don't become part of the problem. It's just, it's not over, folks.
So, a couple of things. One, the university is now, President Robbins and the Senior Vice President for Research, Betsy Cantwell, is promoting the formation of a new center, which is basically aimed at predicting future pandemics and also learning how to live through it. And part of that is, in fact, wastewater-based epidemiology. I mentioned how it's useful when you do have a pandemic, but it's just as useful when you don't, because if there's no virus, for example, in the wastewater, you know you're okay. And then if you start
right,
to see some in there, you
right,
know something's coming. But you're going to see a lot of innovation coming down the pike. Technology companies are producing kits to enhance the speed with which we can process the sample. It's rather a laborious process to get the sample ready for the test to look for the virus. A lot of new things going on. We've also been doing some fundamental work as well as, you know, just that little thing of saving a few lives. We're
right,
also doing some basic research.
Right.
In which, and I won't get down into the weeds with this, but we are able to quantify the number of asymptomatic cases, the percent of asymptomatic cases. It's a secret number, I can't tell you, but it's a big number. And from that, we may be a lot closer to herd immunity than people think.
Oh my gosh, that's wonderful. I feel like that's inside scoop right here on Mrs. Green's World. No, that's really so positive. And, you know, people are just so, if you're like us and our family and our friends, we're just so tired of being good and behaving, if that makes sense. It's like, it's just, I don't want to be a good guy. I want to go to the bar and have a margarita. It's just wonderful. And I just sit here with these series that we're doing, beaming with pride to be a Wildcat alum and to be an environmental educator and to know what a hub the University of Arizona is and on the forefront of all of these amazing things. And I know Betsy has had a lot to do with that, and President Robbins giving her that opening and the opportunity. So I want to know another inside scoop, Ian. Kelly told me this, so I'm ratting her out. Did you get a special call from the U of A President Bobby Robbins about something else? Was it late one night, or isn't there good news about you being recognized for your work?
Yes, there was a phone call, and he ultimately congratulated me on being nominated to Regents Professor. So that was...
didn't tell me what it was. She did not tell me what it was. So there. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a secret.
Okay, well, it is. It's your secret is safe with me and about to our million listeners. No problem. but the show doesn't come out for like a week or two.
Okay.
So is there anything else that you wish I had asked that I didn't, that you don't feel complete about as we come to a very, very wonderful conclusion?
It's not a matter of you asking a question. I'd just like to say that I'm very proud of the West Center. I'm the director of it now. And the reason the West Center came into being was because basically I'd been collaborating with them since about 1985. So we designed the West Center, but Pima County Wastewater paid for it. The University of Arizona didn't pay one penny for this facility. Now,
I have chills. I do.
And now the university pays like the utility bills.
So I'm glad that you talked about that because I had no idea. It's another thing. So it's on the university campus, is it?
No, we're off campus. Ruthroff and close to the freeway. It's a beautiful vista. We look out onto... the Catalina is there. And the other thing I'll say about the West Center, I'm very proud of the fact that on the one hand, we do fundamental research, basic research, but we also do research that really dramatically affects the community and, improves the health of the community. And I think that's very important. So... it's a good thing.
I just think it's really a good thing. And Ian, typically at the end, I make a joke about it because my mother used to say, you always have to have the last word, Regina. And I remember one time saying, you always have to have the last word, Regina. And that was not a good reaction on my part because my mother came right after me. But so I make a joke out of it. But I think I'm going to change it after this very thoughtful conversation with you to reflections because I don't write it all up. I just think while I'm doing this and I put some notes down, so I'm going to change it to reflections because that's really what it is. And it gets a little bit, I do wax a little poetic and sentimental and emotional, but clearly my life is better. My knowledge increased. My hope for the future is brighter because of amazing human beings like you, Ian Pepper. I wish I could do a poll of all of our listeners asking you, all of you, how much you knew about any of what we discussed prior to this interview. And more than that, not only we learned it, but you put it to us in a way that we could really understand your very complicated, very scientific world. And what I knew, I think, could be summed up in a very few short sentences, if that. So I invite everybody to think about and reflect on what we just learned about Ian Pepper's research and his work and his team's work and his passion and his accomplishments. It begged the question, do you know anybody else on the planet who wears a shirt out in public that says, poop doesn't lie? I, for one, do not. Dr. Pepper, I think the original Dr. Pepper, is one of those people quietly, passionately, successfully conducting research that doesn't sound too sexy or appealing to me, but it saves lives, yours and mine, and others that help. And it helps us prepare for a future that isn't always bright and one that can be better and healthier and more sustainable because of the amazing work of human beings like Dr. Pepper and the people who have stepped up to join him on his journey. So thank you, Ian Pepper, for your work, your passion, your important research, and your willingness to spend time with me and with Kelly and our listeners to educate us about pieces of your journey. I am truly appreciative.
It's been my pleasure and it's been great fun.
It's been great fun. I was thinking about this. I'm laughing a lot over such an important subject and the applied research, but you have to kind of have the sense of humor when you're talking about poop.
That's right.
That's what I'm going to say. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. So thank you so much, and we will spread the word about this impactful podcast, and I will call personally and say, Jim Beiser, thanks for picking another winner for this series. So thanks, Ian, and I can't wait for our paths to cross again.
Very good.
Thank you.